Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you Sword and Sandal Cinema. And we begin with A Legend of Hercules, namely BBC's Atlantis. Since Plato first penned his foundational works, many a tale teller has spun a fantastic yarn of long ago times and set it in ancient Atlantis. One of the most recent was a television series that explored the lost continent through the lens of Greek mythology. Epic heroes like Jason and Hercules, along with historical figures like Pythagoras, adventure in a land not unlike Minoan Crete, and they revisit the classical legends. Though unseen, Poseidon remains a powerful presence. Alas, the series was not renewed for a third season, which is unfortunate as it was leading to the voyage of the Argo. But the two-season adventure is now immortalized on streaming platforms, Blu-ray, and DVD. And now we're going to review an episode, and then we'll proceed to Ron Carson's Colosseum. Episode 7, The Rules of Engagement. In response to the announcement of Ariadne's upcoming marriage to Terion, Jason enters the Pangration, a deadly contest in hopes of winning her hand. Seeking to destroy their mutual affection, Pasiphae blackmails Ariadne and arranges for Heptarion to poison Jason. She has also been poisoning Minos slowly and grooming Heptarion to be the next king. Hercules and Medusa manage to rekindle their romantic feelings. Jason triumphs but does not kill Heptarion. This leads to the destruction of Heptarion's engagement with Ariadne. Pasiphae then takes cruel vengeance on Minos' daughter. And we will continue next time with the Furies. Dun, dun, dun. And now to Ron Carson and Ron Carson's Colosseum. Greetings, Ron. How are you?
Good evening, Sadafe. I'm doing okay. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Immersed in ancient Greek material, so I'm happy.
Yeah, I heard you. Taste of our heritage over here, which is so awesome.
Yes, and you're taking us to part of our cultural heritage as humans, Attila the Hun tonight, with Anthony Quinn, Zorba the Greek.
That's right, and he is the starring, actor in that particular production, which was directed by Pietro Francisci and produced by Dino De Laurentiis and Sophia Loren's then-husband, Carlo Ponti. And they are the two main characters of this production. Of course, you said Anthony Quinn was Attila, and Sophia Loren portrays Honoria. And the Hun's antagonist, Henri Vidal, Flavius Aetius, also is a co-star, and one of our legendary Greek actresses, Yanini Pappas, plays one of Attila's wives. And Scott Marlowe actually made his screen debut in this movie. Now, keep in mind, this film was released in 1954 overseas, but did not make it to the States until 1958.
Why is
that? Well, sometimes these sword and sandal films, they pretty much get a tryout overseas, but when it comes to the distribution and release, it kind of like delays sometimes. And this is not the first sword and sandal film that experienced the, the 4-year hiatus. I mean, there were other movies of that stature as well. Also, this is the vehicle that launched the career of Joseph E. Levine, who was a producer and distributor of many international films. A bunch of them in Italian, of course. Joseph E. Levine was very, very prevalent in the world of cinema, if you remember.
Yes, he launched the first Hercules movie with Steve Reeves and started the Apple phenomenon.
That is correct. So, excuse me, he pretty much made his debut with this particular picture. And Attila the Hun was a very, very big, popular deity for the German people, if you remember.
Uh-huh.
and watching an episode of one of my favorite shows in the whole wide world, Hogan's Heroes, Colonel Klink kind of mentions nonchalantly about Attila the Hun that he was pretty much a staple in their particular source of, you know, genre, so to speak. But let me take you back to where this movie starts. It takes place in 450 A.D. Anno Domini, and it's all about the Huns move towards a land called Germania. Attila, of course, is the leader, and the Roman general Flavius Aetius, I hope I pronounced that right, is the only person who knows Attila because he was held captive from the Huns for years.
Uh-huh.
Now, there was a thought, there was news that King Rua, the Roman emperor, has died, and the two brothers, Bleda and Attila, are ruling the kingdom. Bleda favors the peace and tolerance, but Attila is at odds with Flavius, and of course tensions develop in more ways than one. So continuing on with the story, which a lot of people are watching right now outside our outdoor cinema over here, Aetius returns to Ravenna and has a showdown with Emperor Valentinian III, but he's not really becoming a leader in this because he's using the position to enjoy himself in the palace and ignores the fact that the Roman Empire is beginning to fall apart. Now, here's where Sophia Loren comes in. Honoria hopes to get rid of this regime, but needs some help and asks Aetius to join her in a so-called coup d'etat. I like the phrase of that, you know?
Yeah.
So Attila and Bleda, excuse me, pretty much declares himself the sole leader of the Huns after he pretty much has a showdown with brother Bleda. And then Flavius Aetius returns to Ravenna and finds Emperor Valentinian enraged in the attempts against his rule of the kingdom. And now the empire is now on the edge of destruction, and Aetius picks up full military power. Meanwhile, Honoria slips away and visits Attila the Hun in his camp, but that's not a very good decision because the battle takes place and is joined by an attack on the Roman encampment, and that's into the Hun camp, and Honoria is hiding in a normal cart and then killed in the movie, and then Aetius is soon killed, and the Romans lose their will to fight. A badly wounded Roman archer fires a deadly shot, killing Bleda, and Attila eventually appears to lose his passion for conquest and plunder. So en route to Rome, Attila pretty much bumps into a procession of Christians, which is led by Pope Leo I. And Leo calmly tells Attila in the movie, quote, innocent blood will not be washed away. It will come back to haunt you, unquote. And with this warning in mind, Attila decides to turn back toward the Swiss Alps, leaving Rome unscathed. So pretty much a situation where he turns his back on Rome and just goes and hides out in another neutral country, as a matter of fact. So, but this movie did very, very well in the box office because it picked up 415 million lira in its release in Italy. That's the equivalent of over $660,000 in American money. But in U.S. Standards, it garnered $2 million, hence the late release. And a lot of that came towards rentals later on because many people did not discover the movie until a lot after the release of it, which was in 1958. So there you have it. It's a very short film, too. I'm surprised. It only runs for 77 minutes, which is less than an hour and a half. And normally, peplum films don't. Excuse me. Peplum films do not last that much of a short time. You at least get anywhere between 90 minutes and maybe 2.5 hours if you're lucky, you know? So there you have it. But either way, it was a success worldwide, and hence the delayed release here in the United States, which pretty much paid off in more ways than one.
When you mentioned you were going to do Attila, I first thought of Jack Palance in Mark of the Pagan.
No, it was, I did decide on the original movie with Anthony Quinn and Sophia Loren, who are two big names in show business. And like I, like you mentioned in the beginning, we know Anthony Quinn from our Greek point in two roles. One is Zorba the Greek, and then he played Arionassus in The Greek Tycoon.
Yes, yes.
And Anthony Quinn was not really a Greek. A lot of people think that he was, because he did speak the language very fluently, if you remember, in these pictures.
Yeah, he was a very
Greek,
but I believe he was Mexican.
Yes, he was born in Mexico, absolutely. You're absolutely right about that. So that's the story of that. But he pretty much embraced our language and our culture, and that's very, very much a feather in our caps over here, with somebody of a status like Anthony Quinn to actually, you know, embody the role of playing Greek characters.
He looked like someone
you
call Barba, you know, like if he lived in your town, you call him Barba, you know. He looked like a
Barba. That's the Greek word for uncle, if you remember.
And he did well with the accent, and he did well with the mannerisms, and he danced very decently as well.
Oh, God, yes. Zorba the Greek was a very entertaining picture. I mean, he very much embodied the role, and I do believe the film was shot in our native land, too, in Greece. So that was about 10 years later, in 1964, after Attila.
The costume looks very nice. I was looking at pictures today. I believe I've seen it sometime in the past, but again, there's so many hundreds of movies that they tend to blend together. I first got into Attila the Hun beyond the movie adaptations when I was in charge of various programs. I was studying like leadership styles, and somebody came out with a book called Leadership Secrets of Attila the Hun. So it tells you how Attila, who was, I believe he and his brother were captives of Rome, became the king of a force that invaded and threatened to destroy Rome. And Valentinian was not from Rome itself, but from the Byzantine Empire, which was mostly Greek. And Attila did turn back at a very enigmatic point and kind of faded out. And I believe that he was murdered by one of his wives or one of his concubines, or that's the rumor.
Yeah, well, that was in the year 434, if you remember. I mean, a little bit later upon the release of this movie, you know? So I would say he was billed as one of the most feared enemies in the Roman Empire. And he also was attempting to take Constantinople in his military career, but it did not happen, actually. And that's where he went over to Italy and took control over there. So, but
they were expert forces.
It's very interesting. I'm looking at pictures of Attila, you know, and he looks like the typical warrior for starters, and it definitely embraces the peplum background because of the scenery and the way people are dressed in the movie, and it kind of like gives you a perspective of another one of the people who tried to conquest a land but just did not succeed in, you know?
You said that it was
Go ahead.
You said that it's playing near you and people are watching it right now. Is it playing out by you?
Well, it's playing right here at our Coliseum. We're doing a screening on it right now.
Oh,
outside.
Okay.
We always do.
Understood.
Yeah, you know, we always have an audience when we're doing this review. And it's not that bad outside. The weather is a little bit chilly, so people are wearing their light jackets. You know, we passed along the free popcorn and soda, too, so they can enjoy. I'm just looking at some facts about Attila the Hun. He did pass away a year after this film was taking place, 450 to 452. They say he died in 453. So,
and am I pretty much correctly, or am I not remembering correctly?
I'm looking at this right now, as a matter of fact. Well, he pretty much had internal bleeding. That's what it says.
Ooh.
And from what I understand, Attila liked his alcohol also, from what I see. So that probably contributed to his passing, too. But
I heard that as well, that he was very fond of his alcohol. Most barbarians in fiction are fond of their grog or their mead or one of the other things. Or their
ale.
So
absolutely.
The whole barbarian archetype is based very much on Attila, on the Celto-Germanic invaders that came down and finally took over Rome, and also the Huns to some extent. So in all of these cultures, there was a fondness for alcohol, according to the stories that I read.
Yeah. But what still perplexes me is the fact that why would the German people consider him like a deity, you know? Do you have an answer for that, Cuz?
No, I don't. I know that the Huns gave their name to Hungary. They settled in Hungary, and that's why it's Hungary. It's land of the Huns. But
right.
I don't know. I know he was highly regarded by Germanic people. I've come across that reference before, but I read that over 30 years ago, so I don't really remember the details. In fact, we just recently found a couple of boxes of books from that time, so maybe I'll look through the books and see if I can locate the information.
Okay. That's a pretty interesting fun fact over here. But he was pretty much honored by many big names, including composer Ludwig von Beethoven also, and the Egyptian Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru also pretty much spotlighted Attila in Glimpses of World History. And a writer, Cecilia Holland, wrote a book in 1973 entitled The Death of Attila.
I think I have that book somewhere.
I'm sure you do at some point. I'm pretty sure you have the movie, too, somewhere in your stack of DVDs.
I'm pretty
sure. Blu-rays
or...
Absolutely. And this is an interesting thing. If you remember when the Turks invaded Cyprus back in 1974, the operation was named the Attila Plan.
I did not know that.
They kind of like did the playback. They kind of like what you call took that into consideration. And yes, Jack Palance did play Attila the Hun in another movie. So
Mark of the Pagan, yeah.
Mark of the Pagan, Sign of the Pagan, actually.
Well, Sign of the Pagan, okay.
Yeah, it's called Sign of the Pagan, and co-starred with him was Jeff, the guy who co-starred with him was Jeff Chandler, if you remember. He was a big-time actor at that time.
My memory for people's names is not as good as yours. You have a very precise memory, as does Athena. Athena remembers... names and things very well. With me, those become a blur after a while.
Ironically, his version, the Jack Palance film, was released in 1954, around the same time as Attila was in Europe. And it picked up a box office of $2.5 million, and of course, with rentals down the road, it up to $6 million, too. So,
I remember having that on VHS.
You have this on your collection?
I used to have it on VHS tape. I remember finding it in Astoria in one of these mom and pop video stores that used to sell their inventory when it got too overfull. I remember I found a copy of Sign of the Pagan, and I was really pleased to find it and happy to find it.
Well, you'd probably get it on DVD. I'm sure Amazon has it.
I'm sure, too.
So, an interesting fun fact about this Jack Palance movie. I don't know. You're not much into sports, but you probably heard of Frank Gifford.
Yes.
Well, he actually worked as a stuntman in this particular picture in the early stages of his career. Yes. And that's another interesting thing. So, and Jeff Chandler told the movie reviewer, Hedda Hopper, that this was the best role he's had. And even though I don't know if Universal actually claimed that this was the most expensive film from that year, you know? I'm just trying to check right now how much it did have a budget of over $1 million, which back then was a lot of money, if you remember.
Uh-huh.
And it did recoup at the box office and then eventually in rentals. That's why it got a take of $6 million in total sales. So, like I said, movies like this sometimes fall through the cracks. And in this case, these are two examples right there where people are actually pretty much what you call discovering these movies later on in their viewing, you know, opportunities. So, but like I said, I'm looking to see if Sign of the Pagan is available on Amazon, you know? So,
did you find it?
Maybe you can get that. I'm typing it right now because, you know, there we go. You can actually get it on Blu-ray and DVD.
Oh, great. Is it reasonably priced?
Yeah, it's reasonably priced for both the Blu-ray and DVD, about $40.
Okay, that's not bad.
So there you go. Now you have a chance to get this back in your collection, too.
It will go on my list of things to get on Amazon.
I'm sure. But there you go. Being that you have a Blu-ray player, too, you're able to watch this. So, and you get the film in both formats, DVD and Blu-ray. So, however, the movie Attila is not available on DVD. I'm looking at it right now. There's just different types of other options. You know what I mean? But it's not one. It's not a film that you're actually able to get in your collection unless you have it. But do you have a copy of that on DVD, Cuz?
I don't know, because it's not with my regular sword and sandal movies, which are out. A lot of my movies are in boxes at this point because they're all over the place. Only my sword and sandal films and my superhero films are out and available right now. So it might be sitting in a box. I might have put it in with my sword and sandal films. I need to look. Plus, I have some collections of like 50 film collections, 20 film collections.
Okay.
It might be somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, your library, you pretty much, you can get lost in it from what I see. You know what I mean?
Yes, I can spend a whole day just looking through my DVDs and not be finished looking through them all. I try every now and then to put them in some sort of order. I try every now and then to give them away or sell them or whatever to lessen my collection, but that doesn't last very long. Brian has the same, challenge before him, and he does much the same thing, but the DVDs move slowly because when you're reviewing them, there's something you find that makes you want to keep it rather than getting rid of it.
Sure. Well, you know, you and I are definitely designated pack rats.
Yep, most certainly so. The dragon.
But all for a good treasure. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
It was called the dragon sickness during Norse mythology times when somebody we collect all sorts of treasures, be they gold or gems or something else, and then sit on them. They would turn into a dragon. So,
yeah. That best describes you, Cuz, for sure. But I do believe Brian's waiting in a few minutes. He's going to give us his take on another drive-in feature, which wholeheartedly would tell your audience to join up on his Facebook page, because, you know, he's bringing back a slice of the past, and that's what makes the hip him so awesome, you know? And give my best to Brian when you talk to him.
So how would people get in contact with you outside of the Coliseum or monthly gathering?
All right. Well, you know, I am available on social media. I have a Facebook page, which you can chime in. Just type in my name on the toolbar. And if you'd like to friend me, I'd be glad to put you into my group. I'm also on the business site LinkedIn also. I'm looking forward to making that type of connection as well. And you can listen to me on weekends at WSBS. I have three shows. Saturday mornings I go on at 7 for a little bit, and then at 10 o'clock we have the Nitty Gritty, which is our escape to the 70s and 80s, which we play music from those two particular decades. And you, the audience, has a say in it, because the playlist is controlled by our listeners, not by me.
Oh, wow.
So give us a call, and if you want to hear one of these tunes from one of those two decades, we'll be glad to accommodate you. And I also wrap up the weekend with a Sunday night show starting at 7 o'clock as well. That'll be on WSBS.com. You can get us on the free app. Just type in WSBS, and you'll be able to listen to the end result, and we'd love to have you aboard.
You're a champion of Sword and Sandal Cinema this month, so please feel free to advertise all your different shows in the site this week.
Well, Cuz, it's an honor that is, you know, truly bestowed, and I take it humbly, and I'm very grateful that my work has been pretty much recognized by your peers and people that are chiming in on our broadcast once a month. And I look forward very much to bringing you up to speed on some movies that have pretty much been a forgotten stature in the realm of Sword and Sandal and or Peplum, you know? So
We do our best, and we're growing. I believe we have nearly 34,000 people in our Sword and Sandal Cinema groups at this point.
That's amazing. Let's keep them coming, so to speak. I mean,
and from globally, from countries I never would have suspected would be interested in.
Oh, I know. That's what's the one good thing about modern technology, is that we are able to reach out worldwide. And when using it correctly and not using it as a platform to, you know, pretty much express your disdain, it's types of groups like this that we really need to get people more involved and more active. And like I said, I'm very proud to be a part of it, because you're not only my cousin, you're my brother, and I basically enjoy dropping by once a month to feature one of our favorite Peplum films from way back when until even the 70s. We go 50s, 60s, and 70s on this particular genre as well. But that is all I have to say. I got to tend to the audience over here as Attila's winding down.
Okay.
Give him a refill of soda or popcorn. Yep.
Thank you.
Which we don't charge.
Thank you for being on. And Sagapo, and I will talk to you very soon, cousin.
Yes, we'll reach out in the next couple of days, okay? Because I got some things I do want to discuss with you, okay?
Hey, be well.
Yeah, you too, Sagapo. And Kalinichta to you and to all that tuned in tonight. And we'll come back again next month and do it all over again, God willing, okay?
Okay, thank you. Yasu, Yahara.
Yahara. Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night. And now, before we proceed to Brian's Drive-In Theater, we have another quick review of BBC's Atlantis Season 1, Episode 8, The Furies. The three epic amigos are hired to escort a caravan to Helios, a perilous undertaking. Pythagoras' brother Arcas arrives and offers to accompany them, which disturbs the mathematician deeply enough to visit the oracle. Her pronouncements are vague but ominous. The desert crossing to Helios is dangerous enough, but the party is also tormented by raiders, omens, betrayal, suspicion, painful memories, and vengeful wind spirits. Pythagoras must confront and reveal his deepest, darkest secret and gain total forgiveness from the one person least likely to grant it. And there we will leave BBC Atlantis and proceed to Brian's Drive-In Theater. Greetings, Brian. How are you, sir?
I am somehow alive today, Hercules. How are you?
Somehow alive? That sounds ominous. What happened?
Yeah, well, you know, it's October. It's my favorite time of year. I love Halloween. I've been averaging about 2 horror films a day. And
wow.
As I said, it's my favorite time of year. And by the way, this is probably the last time I'll talk to you before Halloween, so happy anniversary.
Thank you very much.
And it was a beautiful day here, as it was, you know, in a lot of areas. It was 72 degrees, sunny, and, you know, thankfully I'm retired. So we got into the Mustang, we put the top down, we drove over to Western Maryland to look at the leaves, which were beautiful, stunning today. Not a cloud in the sky. I mean, just had a really nice lunch in Maryland. And as we were driving back to West Virginia, there were all of these cops, well, policemen, I should say, state police, state troopers, along the road on I-68. And they were, looked like they were preparing for something, you know. Some of them were, you know, warning us to slow down, and all of a sudden we got into this really bad traffic jam where nothing was moving. That part of I-68 is the middle of nowhere. There's an exit like once every like 8 or 9 miles. That's not an exaggeration either. It's just nothing there. We got stopped right beside an exit, and we sat there for a while, and I thought, you know what? This is West Virginia. There's a back road to everything. You know, I'll be able to figure this out. And keep in mind, I'm in a rear-wheel drive convertible. The top's down. And we were put on the path, this hellish path, trying to get back to civilization. And there was one point at which there was a Jeep Gladiator pickup in front of me that would not go further because this person was afraid. And even in the convertible, I went ahead and just stuck my foot on the accelerator and went up. And I'm here tonight to tell you about it. There were people stuck in traffic for 4 hours. There was a massive chain reaction accident. There was a dump truck that was full of gravel that flipped over onto its side. There was also a cement mixer that flipped, and it slung cement over both the eastbound and westbound lanes of the interstate. There were chain reaction accidents behind these accidents, and westbound on I-68 is still closed. And we hit that around, I want to say, 1:30 or so, and it's 9:30 now and still closed. It was
wow.
A mess. And like I said, I could not begin to tell you the route, the circuitous route that we had to take. This is a very mountainous area in the state, and there's a lake in the middle of all of it. So you have to navigate around that as well. And we somehow made it. And I don't think the car depreciated too much. but it was horrific. It really was scary. And speaking of scary, we're going to talk about scary movies tonight, but we're going to talk about scary peplum.
That is an awesome topic. And
it is. And one of the movies we're going to
appropriate.
Well, and one of the movies we're going to talk about is among your favorites with perhaps your favorite sword and sandal actor. But the movies that I wanted to talk about are either Peplum, and there's a number of Peplum films that have some really effectively used horror elements. But a lot of the actors that we associate with Peplums also went on to do straight up horror films, you know, ones that did not have, you know, any Peplum elements, but, you know, were horror films. And just to throw one of those out for right now, Frankenstein 80 with Gordon Mitchell in the role of Dr. Yeah, and Gordon Mitchell portrays Dr. Otto Frankenstein, and John Richardson is sort of the dashing male lead in it. And he was an English actor who he was very successful in the 60s. He was in, you know, 1 Million BC with Raquel Welch. He was married to Martine Beswick for a few years in the late 60s and early 70s. And Martine Beswick was a Bond girl. She was in Thunderball. She was also in, oh, golly, it's the second Bond movie. She's not credited in it, but she has a scene in it. And I can't think of, From Russia with Love. Okay, that's the second Bond movie. And she was in a lot of horror films, you know, in the 70s, including Seizure with Jonathan Frid from Dark Shadows. Beautiful and very talented actress. But Gordon Mitchell is, you know, obviously, you know, got his he got his first starring roles in Peplum films. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that he did just within the span of a couple of years. Made two Frankenstein films. In Frankenstein 80 from 1972, he's Dr. Frankenstein. But in Frankenstein's Castle of Freaks from 1974, he is Igor. So it's nice to see it's nice to see Gordon in a variety of different roles. You know, among the sword and sandal actors, he's the one who did by far, you know, the most films. In fact, well, there for a while, I would say about 20 years ago, or so around the time he passed away, which was 20 years ago last month, as a matter of fact. I tried to watch every film in his filmography, but it's nearly impossible. Because for one thing, there are so many films in his filmography. And by his own count, he surmised that he was probably in more than 200 films.
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. But it's also impossible to track down 200 films that were shot on, you know, let's say, three different or four different continents. You know, it's you know, so hard to find, you know, copies of all of those films. And you remember 20 years ago, you know, if you could find a copy of anything, whether it was on, you know, DVD or even VHS back then, you got it no matter what. You know, now you have, you know, so much. So, well, in theory, I guess I should say, we have so much more at our fingertips. Unfortunately, as I find that, you know, the end of physical media is upon us. I'm afraid that we're not going to have access to DVD sales, at least new ones, for that much longer.
The tide is turning, though. A lot of collectors on YouTube and other medium, you know, when they talk about, you know, what's going on with DVDs and Blu-rays and TV shows and whatnot, they're very upset that with digital media, the studios could erase things at any given point in time or change things at any given point in time.
And you're right. Your streaming services regularly remove films from their catalogs. For a case in point, I wanted to watch Renfield with Nicolas Cage.
Uh-huh.
And I'd still like to see it. But I can't remember if it was on Paramount Plus or Peacock. I can't remember which platform it was on. But we were going to watch it, you know, finally, and they'd already removed it. Fortunately, it's on Prime. So we can watch it there. Hopefully it's still on Prime. This was as of last week.
We just watched it again on Prime earlier this week. So I know it's still on Prime.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, we watched it again. Okay. It was such a good movie. We enjoyed watching it the first time. So I didn't catch the Demeter either. So that one I was able to reserve for my local library. So I'll get to see that soon.
Well, one of the things that I've been working on for the past couple of weeks this fall is I've been going back through my physical media, in this case DVDs. And I have a formidable collection at this point of purchased DVDs, along with a really healthy collection of burned DVDs that we have made. You know, Greg records everything, and for a long time, we would move things that we couldn't find on purchased DVDs if we could find them. You know, on Turner Classic Movies is an obvious source, but there were some other sources as well that we would use. We would go ahead, record them on DVR, and then move them over to DVD. Well, I've been going through all of that for two reasons. For one, I've wanted to go through our both collections, and we have them alphabetized, so it makes it easier. And figure out, am I ever going to watch this again? Or did I ever watch it? I have found a shocking number of DVDs that either have absolutely no memory of watching or I just never did watch it. So we've been going through a lot of those. And I thought it would be easy to pare the collection down, maybe by half. And I might have gotten rid of about 30 so far.
I'm in the same boat. I have so many DVDs especially. I used to have VHSs too, but then we had that storm that flooded my basement and it killed most of my VHS collection. I've been trying to whittle down my DVDs also. So I've been taking out duplicates because when it changed the cover and because of the fact that things have different titles, I wound up with duplicate copies of movies. But still, the amount that I give away is so minuscule compared to the amount that I have that's still there. And it doesn't help that you can get DVDs now for like 50 cents new to $1.25 new. In what were formerly called 99-cent stores. And in libraries, they're like a quarter each for used DVDs. So I'm always adding to my collection faster than I can whittle down my collection as well.
Well, same here, to be quite honest. A lot of the new stuff, if you do find something pretty esoteric that you know you're never going to find on streaming, that stuff can be kind of pricey. You can pay quite a bit of money for a fairly well known horror film whenever it hits DVD or let's say Blu-ray, not DVD. If it's been restored, if it's 4K, those can run into some money. They're not inexpensive.
No.
And like I said, I thought that it would be much easier just to wind my way through the collection and say, okay, we don't need this. We don't need that. We don't need this. And this has been opening Pandora's box.
Yep.
I've also been comparing the purchased DVDs from the ones that we've made, and what I have found, I did find some overlap there. Probably there again, about maybe 20 movies or so. But particularly when it comes to the public domain titles, what I have found is that more than likely, the ones that we have burned oftentimes look better than the ones we purchased. And these are public domain titles, or what I believe to be public domain titles. That's probably a better way to put it. So I've been getting rid of the Alpha Video Classic because we've got better copies of them. They may have very slick and interesting cover art, but at the end of the day, it really depends on what it sounds like and what it looks like. And like I said, I've just been impressed at over the last 25 years, we've been burning DVDs. So some of these are really old, You know, and you can tell by the weight of them. If you pick up either a manufactured DVD or one you burned yourself that is old, let's say 20 years old, it and the case weigh way more than the stuff you buy now. I mean,
yes.
Have you noticed that? And the same thing also happened with VHS.
Yes.
With VHS, it was the same way. And I'm ashamed to say I probably still do have some VHS cassettes that are now more than 40 years old. And when I compare them to the ones that are now more than 25 years old, there's a significant weight difference. They were built to last, the old ones. Believe it or not, the very first VHS player recorder that I've ever purchased is still on this planet. It is still with us.
Oh, wow. My first one
works.
That's amazing. Mine died long ago, but I remember it cost like nearly $500. And the first movie that I bought for it was Conan the Barbarian with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and that cost $80. At the time in the early 80s, that was a substantial amount to be saving and putting away to watch Conan. But I had to have it.
But the thrill of it was that whenever you wanted to watch Conan the Barbarian, you actually could.
Yeah.
Now, that might have been the only thing you could watch. But still, I don't think, you know, let's say my students today, I'm teaching a couple of college classes this fall for our College of Business and Economics at WVU. And I don't think they understand the fact that, you know, once upon a time, if you wanted to watch a certain television show, you had to be at home at 9 o'clock in front of the television to do it. Otherwise, you weren't going to see it. You couldn't just call things up, you know, automatically or log into YouTube and then find whatever it was that you wanted. You know, it just wasn't a thing.
No.
And it just wasn't. But now we're so lucky because, you know, as I was preparing for tonight, I watched several movies and, believe it or not, I resorted to a lot of the physical media that I own and unfortunately found that in a couple of cases, there were better copies online than the ones that I have. Well, and but there's I probably should add a footnote to that, though. I wanted to watch Hercules in the Haunted World, which I watched yesterday.
Awesome movie.
There's a Blu-ray that you can buy, and I have apparently been under the misconception that I own that Blu-ray because I don't. It's not in my collection. It is not in the online listing that I have of all of our DVDs. I kept thinking that I had purchased it, but I apparently didn't. And when I went through the listing of DVDs that we have, I found that I had several copies of Hercules in the Haunted World, but they're terrible copies. They're Mill Creek copies from, let's say, 2006. they're pan and scan. They're not widescreen. They're just not good copies. And the copies that you can find on archive.org and YouTube, you can find some beautiful widescreen copies on those two streaming platforms. And Hercules in the Haunted World is public domain, so you know, anybody can share that. And what a great movie. In terms of being a peplum, you know, it actually passes as a straight-up horror film as well.
Very, very powerfully.
And very well. It was wonderfully directed by Mario Bava, who did a lot of horror films. If you've ever seen Black Sunday with Barbara Steele, that's a Mario Bava effort there. And you can see it when you watch, having seen as many of his films as I have, you can almost tell when they come on if it's his film because of the lighting and the bright and vivid colors that he uses. There's no pastels in a Mario Bava film. Everything is Technicolor times 10. The colors and the lighting are so vivid and bright and stark. It really comes through in when you are trying to do a horror film, because, you know, in horror films, you're trying to present an alternative reality. It shouldn't look quite like real life, right?
Right.
Right. Well, at least it didn't to Mario Bava. And Hercules in the Haunted World is a great example of one of his films, and what a master he was. He had been a cinematographer, you know, for years before doing any directing, and he did a lot of directing in films in the 50s and early 60s, but didn't get credited for it. For example, he directed a substantial portion of Hercules Unchained. And if you go back and watch Hercules Unchained, you can almost see, you know, the portions that he had a hand in, because he was so good and knew what he was doing. But another factor another thing that I think, you know, gives Hercules in the Haunted World more horror street cred is that Christopher Lee is the antagonist, which is and he's great at it. I don't think he gets enough screen time in it. I would like to see Christopher Lee be more evil. he's really good at it, you know. He can be sinister at the drop of a hat. And there's also a love story. If you look at the rest of the cast list in Hercules in the Haunted World, the actors there are, you know, seasoned pros for the most part, people who did, you know, numerous films. Leonora Ruffo is one of them. She's also in Goliath and the Vampires with Gordon Scott, which was produced the same year in 1961. And another great horror peplum. Going back into the physical media, my copy of The Witch's Curse is horrible, and that's the film with Kirk Morris and Helena Chanel.
Yes, I have that.
It has great horror elements in it. My copy of it is horribly old, though. It's a something weird video, DVD, and you'll remember the 20 years, well, the heck, 30 years ago, if you look back into VHS, Mike Graney did so much for the hobbyist who was looking for, you know, obscure titles on VHS and then later DVD. And Something Weird Video, unfortunately, perished with him, essentially. He passed away almost 10 years ago now, and his widow, or wife, I should say, is winding the business down. There are no new DVDs coming out, and I believe there's a streaming service out there where you can stream, you know, a lot of Something Weird's titles. But the copy that I have is a Something Weird copy. It's actually a second feature. The first feature is Hercules Against the Moon Men, which is one of your favorite films.
Yes,
with one of your favorite peplum actors, mm-hmm. Alan Steele, otherwise known as Sergio Chiani. And Johnny Clare is the evil queen in it. And you can see her, you know, in a few peplums here and there. But great as the evil queen. And there again, you know, that's another peplum film that I think could really stand up on its own in the horror genre.
I think so, too. And we've had this conversation before, and I'm sure we're going to have it again. I want to do something with that movie. It's in the public domain. So I have several ideas.
Indeed it is.
I've been playing with over the years, but definitely at some point before I leave the planet, I'm going to do something interesting with that movie.
And I'd be remiss without mentioning Medusa Against the Son of Hercules with Richard Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
That movie is genuinely creepy. It has some sequences that I think really are frightening. The worst thing you can say about a horror film is that it didn't produce a reaction. And you, and trust me, this month I've watched a few that had absolutely no chills at all. And I won't mention the titles, but you know, occasionally somebody will come up with a great title, but the script is never going to live up to it. And I've watched more than a few of those, unfortunately. I have watched some really great horror films this month, though, and things that I really hadn't seen before. We watched one last night, and this is not Peplum, but we watched one last night, which was an Amicus production. Amicus was a studio that sort of rivaled Hammer in the 1960s and in 1970s. They produced a lot of horror films. Oftentimes with the same cast that Hammer often put in their horror films. And Torture Garden is an Amicus anthology film where they would have a brief vignette. They would usually collect the main characters in a certain locale. They would draw them there, and then they would tell their evil tales, things they either had done or would do because they were essentially evil people. And Torture Garden stars Burgess Meredith, and he is the carnival barker, sideshow guy who draws people in. One of the people he draws in is Beverly Adams, who was an actress in the 60s. She's in How to Stuff a Wild Bikini and later went on to be known as Beverly Sassoon because she married Vidal Sassoon. And
on that note, we're going to have to wrap up. We have 3 more minutes. I just looked at the clock.
Okay.
But to be continued, we will definitely continue this.
Anyway, Torture Garden is available on Blu-ray along with 2 other films, including The Creeping Flesh with Peter Cushing. And I got to tell you, I have probably seen Peter Cushing every day this month. He is in every other horror film. And he is excellent in all of them. Now, he's in a few stinkers, but what an actor. He's great, and there's a lot of pathos to his acting. He doesn't overact. He's a very sturdy, quality actor. He really is. Much respect for Peter Cushing. And if you want to interact with me on social media, I'm on Facebook most all of the time. I'm also on X, which we all know used to be called Twitter. But I'm, other than lurking on X, I don't really interact with anybody anymore. Given what I've been hearing about X, I'm not sure I'm going to be on it much longer anyway, especially if you have to start paying for it. So find me on Facebook or look me up on the World Wide Web at briansdriveintheater.com.
And Brian's Drive-In Theater is a shrine to not only sword and sandal cinema, but also lots of B-movies in very many genres. Brian, thank you very much. You are a living legend, and I'm honored that you're here on the show. And I look forward to our next conversation. Thank you for your well wishings. I wish you a happy Halloween as well.
Happy Halloween to you, and happy anniversary.
Thank you so very much, and thank you to our wonderful audience. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called in and you're waiting in our queue and listening, or whether you're going to check us out later on. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everybody, and thanks again, Brian.